Sure, y'all come on in, take your shoes off, sit on down.
Y'all listening to
In the Corner, back by the woodpile.
Hey y'all, this is Spun Counter Guy. Thanks for listening. First of all, I need to apologize. We had a bit of a technical problem on this podcast, so there's a bit of a buzz through some of the recording. My guest today, I would say, is an encyclopedia of musical knowledge. Some people might call him a musicologist, and he's also a pretty good guy. His name is Kells Cook. If you've ever lived in Nashville, you may have known Kells from his days as an employee at one of the great institutions of Nashville, The Great Escape. The Great Escape was a shop that carried everything from used records to comic books to posters to just anything media related that was awesome and possibly banged up a little. Kells also, along with Randy Fox, hosted the Hitbilly Jamboree, which was a radio show on Vanderbilt's WRVU. Kells joined me back by the woodpile so I could pick his brain about some of my favorite rock and roll and country artists. We started our conversation off with me asking Kells about Bill Haley and his big hit, Shake, Rattle, and Roll. I said, shake, rattle, and roll. I said, shake, rattle, and roll. Well, you never do nothing to save your doggone soul.
Well, it was originally a hit for Big Joe Turner. Jesse Stone, an Atlantic Records songwriter, wrote it, and he himself has a history going back to the 30s. But yeah, you know, Bill Haley, you know, had the pop hit with it. Basically, Bill had been around for almost 10 years previous to that. He'd been leading a lot of Western swing bands out of Chester, Pennsylvania, most notably Bill Haley and the Saddlemen, for a few years there. And he started to tour around a little bit, and he would hit the Midwest. He'd hit Kansas City and St. Louis, and he'd start to hear records from people like Big Joe Turner. And he started to think, wow, if I could mix this with what I'm already doing, I could really come up with something. So he was already being a musical alchemist the way that Sam Phillips was in Memphis. He was thinking in those terms too before Elvis ever walked into the Memphis Recording Service in 53. He was starting to think, okay, I love blues. I love Howlin' Wolf. That's where the soul of man never dies. But he knew that he couldn't sell someone that wild ass to polite white society. He knew that he had a limited market.
Him and Sam Phillips.
Yeah. For you know, selling, you know, Howlin' Wolf's records to Chess. Yeah. Or even if he decided to, you know, put them out on his own label, which he was starting about that time with Sun Records. He knew that he'd be selling to a lot of local folks and folks in the Delta, maybe all the way up to Chicago, but he wouldn't be selling those records to polite white society in New York City or the West Coast or what have you. So he was thinking, okay, if I could find, you know, a scrubbed up white kid who still sang in that style, I could probably sneak it in. And that's kind of what Bill Haley was thinking of doing too, although he was that scrubbed up white guy, and he just dug the music. And I think he was thinking, okay, maybe, you know, this could be something that I could sell to the masses too. So eventually, you know, he broke away from Essex Records and the other indies that he'd put records out on over the previous years, and got to Decca through Milt Gabler in New York City, and started to make records there. And his first record actually was Rock Around the Clock and 13 Women, but they put out 13 Women as the A-side initially, right after Bill had recorded it, and it flopped. What ended up happening, though, was there was a kid whose name escapes me, I hate to admit it, but there was a kid who had really dug Bill's previous record for Essex, which was Crazy Man Crazy. And when he saw this new record, 13 Women, in the racks, he snapped it up and took it home. And he was really disappointed. He didn't like it at all. But then he flipped it over, and here's this other song, Rock Around the Clock. And he really liked that. And his dad, again, I can't think of his name, was a film producer in Hollywood, and he was putting together the film Blackboard Jungle, which was about teenage, you know, bad kids, juvenile delinquents in the classroom and the troubles that they were causing. He had, you know, Jamie Farr was in the movie, Sidney Poitier. They were all kids in the classroom. And he was putting together this movie, and he thought, wow, listen to this. Listen to that backbeat. This would be a perfect number for the opening credits. And, about a year later, yeah, Rock Around the Clock was a big hit thanks to its inclusion in that film. But in the meantime, after the flop of 13 Women, Decca followed it up with Bill's version of Shake, Rattle, and Roll. And it was a decent-sized pop hit, and that did end up breaking the mainstream open, you know, to the idea of rock and roll. Yeah, you had that, and then you had the Platters hitting with Only You. You know, both Bill Haley and the Platters had national hits before Elvis hit the charts with his RCA.
And just to help folks, before this, what was the most popular music in America at that time?
Well, it was basically, you know, pop vocal music, kind of post-big band vocalists. People,
for example?
Well, people like Sinatra, although even he had had his low ebb there in the late 40s, early 50s, before he jumped over to Capitol and reinvented himself as the finger-snapping, you know, the hipster cat. But, you know, people like Tony Bennett, who had brought Hank Williams' Cold, Cold Heart to the masses. Because, again, hillbilly was as limited a market as blues. Rock and roll. Rhythm and blues and blues was. Mm-hmm. And you had to have someone like Tony Bennett cover it for the masses to get into it. Mm-hmm. So Tony Bennett, you had Patti Page with Tennessee Waltz, Mockingbird Hill, How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? Joe Stafford, K-Star, you know, quality records. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of historians, especially a lot of baby boomer types, want to act like, oh, it was all horrible, cliched, white bread pop music before rock and roll took off. And it wasn't. A lot of those records are quite nice, but you wouldn't call them edgy. You wouldn't call them, you know, terribly energetic outside of, you know, Sinatra at his swinginest. Yeah. But, you know, they were nice records. They were just orchestrated, and it was kind of lush lullabies for the masses.
Next, I wanted to ask Kells about a lyric in Shake, Rattle, and Roll, which probably was one of the filthiest to ever hit mainstream radio up to that point and for a long time after.
I'm like a one-eyed cat peeping in a seafood store.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, Big Joe Turner had been singing it for an adult crowd.
Yeah.
So he had the line, you wear those dresses, the sun comes shining through, can't believe my eyes, all that mess belongs to you. Well, yeah, you know, Decca decided that, you know, Bill, we're going to, you know, give this to, you know, to people listening to the radio at 8 o'clock in the morning, yeah. People taking their kids to school. We can't have that line in there. So they skipped that one. The funny thing is, when they got rid of that, they didn't get rid of the real dirty line.
Filthy.
Yeah, which is, I'm like a one-eyed cat peeping in a seafood store. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they were just hearing that, thinking in cartoon terms, like, oh, isn't that funny? That's cute, a little alley cat who just poked in his head into a seafood store, but that's actually all, like, you know, black euphemisms you know, male and female genitalia.
Yeah.
And if you think about it a little bit, you know what the one-eyed cat is, and you can figure out what that seafood store is.
Sure.
And that line stayed in his, and then, you know, a year later, when RCA Victor signed Elvis, you know, they had him cut that one early on, and that verse stayed in there, too.
How long did it take for people to kind of figure it out?
Decades.
Did Bill Haley know?
I don't know. I've never heard that he did or didn't. You know, I would imagine that, you know, it's quite possible that, you know, Jesse Stone may have known, Big Joe may have known, and they probably, you know, were laughing when they were cutting it.
Laughing all the way to the bank?
Yeah, eventually, yeah. Or at least Jesse Stone did. I mean, Big Joe Turner wasn't getting any royalties from Bill Haley's hit, but Jesse Stone was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, who knows? You know, it may not have been until the 70s and the 80s when you actually had a lot of writers and rock historians who were, you know, kind of telling the real story of rock and roll, that people started to say, oh, is that what that means? Oh, I didn't know. And even now, it's kind of a secret. You know, a lot of people will hear Shake, Rattle, and Roll, and they'll still, you know, think that it's like a Looney Tunes cartoon or a 30s, you know, Steamboat Willie kind of knockoff.
Sure, sure.
Next up, Webb Pierce.
I was rambling through a Texas border town. Just another guy with plenty of time.
Well, he started his career really as a men's shirt salesman at a Sears Roebuck in Shreveport, Louisiana. That, of course, is where the Louisiana Hayride was broadcast out of, and that's how people started to get hip to Webb, and he started to make records for labels like Four Star and Pacemaker, and that eventually brought him to Nashville, where he started to record for Decca and started to have hits with Wanderin', which was actually, the first record with Bud Isaacs playing a pedal steel on, which made a lot of people, lap steel guitar players just flip out and think, how's he getting those tones? How's he getting those notes? Without realizing that he was using pedals to bend the notes. So that was a real seminal record. And then, a year later, There Stands the Glass was a, defining honky-tonk record, too. So there you go.
Stands the glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one to take.
Then we talked about Virginia Hensley, better known as Patsy Cline.
Baby, baby, let's go tonight together, you and me. Baby, baby, when you hold me tight, ooh-wee, what you do to me? On the clock, tell me that it's time to rock. Got a lot of rhythm in my soul.
Now, Patsy's another artist who went from Four Star to Decca. The first 3 years or so that she was recording, she was tied to Four Star for publishing reasons, even though Decca was putting out the bulk of the records. And basically, she was, recording a lot of four-star material, which, in a lot of cases weren't terrible songs, but they weren't necessarily, great songwriting either. She made a lot of really good honky-tonk and almost, proto-rockabilly-style records, but the only major hit she had when she was with Four Star was Walking After Midnight. Although she did record Just a Closer Walk With Me, since it was gospel material and wasn't so tightly tied down copyright-wise. Yeah, she did that for Four Star, too. But then, eventually, when she broke out of that contract in 1960 and started making records with Owen Bradley for Decca, that's where she started to make records like I Fall to Pieces, which was a Harlan Howard song, Crazy, which was a Willie Nelson song. That's where she, really started to get the first-rate material that she deserved. It's kind of like how, Billie Holiday, when she was starting out in the early 30s, she wasn't being fed the absolute best material, but you don't notice it because that's Billie Holiday singing. She could go through your garbage and sing it and sound like a classic. Right. So there you go.
Just a closer walk with thee.
I am weak, but thou art strong. Jesus, keep me from all wrong. I'll be satisfied as long as I walk. Let me walk close to thee.
Next, I ask Kells his opinion on the 1985 biographical film Sweet Dreams, which is about Patsy Cline and stars Jessica Lange.
I haven't watched it in probably close to 25 years. I do remember thinking it looked pretty glossy, pretty 80s. For instance, I had a friend back in the 80s who saw the movie first and idealized Patsy Cline. And it's like, oh, I've got to get into her. And he went to the record store and picked up an album by her and almost screamed just at the cover, because he was envisioning her looking like Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
I think Patsy's a knockout for who she was. Yeah. I think she was a terrific looking woman. But again, I really love the records too. So, you know, it comes with the territory. It's yeah. kind of like
she wasn't a supermodel.
No, not at all. But yeah. you know, I don't think she's any less attractive than Martha Carson or Kay Starr or yeah. You know, I mean, there are some people who might scream if they saw Aretha Franklin or Brian Wilson or Roy Orbison. Yeah. Oh, but when they open their mouths, it's a whole other story. So yeah. I guess it depends. You know, if you're already in love with the music. Yeah. Then you know you can't help but love the person and the image too. But therein lies the difference between, you know, the 50s and the 60s and our post MTV world. You get hit with the image first, or at least simultaneously with the music, and you have to be a supermodel now, which is why the music sucks. It's because they're going to modeling agencies now, finding people with the right look or the look that they've decided is marketable at any given time, and then they'll put the quote unquote artist in the studio. Usually it's a digital recording, which you can manipulate all you want to. If someone sings a bum note, they can change the tone without changing the speed, which is why I think the only, you know, real good recordings are analog recordings, because you can't change the tone without changing the speed. If you sing a bum note, it's locked in there with the rest of the music. And so, you know, if you hit a bum note, just keep it on there. It gives it personality, humanity. That's why I think people still love people like Ernest Tubb and Webb Pierce, because they would occasionally hit a bum note, but therein lies their humanity.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you.
Next up, Ronnie D., who recorded this song when he was a teenager.
Give me the downbeat, Mastro. I want to lay it on the line. Because everything I do, I want to do it in double time. When I take a ride in my car, I let it roll. Hear me? I said let it roll. I like to feel that wind in my face. Nice and cold. If you chicks are timid, you just better turn back. Because when I take a ride in my car, it's got to be action back. Hear me? Action back.
Well, his real name is Ronnie Dawson. Now, the first Ronnie Dawson stuff that I actually heard was the stuff he did in the late 80s, early 90s, when he made his comeback. Because he made these records in the 50s and early 60s, then went away for quite a while. And it wasn't until the late 80s when you actually had some people in England letting them know that, hey, those records you made in Texas in the 50s, those are going for big money on the collector's market. Oh, really? Okay, and they brought him back into the studio. You actually had Boz Borer, who was Morrissey's guitar player, was one of the first guys to let him know. And the CD that I got into him with first was the Monkey Beat CD, which is actually two albums he made in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's ferocious, just red-blooded rock and roll. But by that point, you know, he's in his late 40s, and his voice has changed 30 years earlier. So to me, when I heard his teenage recordings, it wasn't really the sentiment that made me think, oh, that's kind of odd. It was his voice. I had to get used to, you know, Ronnie Dawson as a 16-year-old instead of as a 48-year-old.
Action back. Hear me? Action back. Yeah. Lot of action, baby. Yeah. Action back.
These iconic chords are from the song Rumble by Fred Lincoln Ray, otherwise known as Link Ray. This track is often cited as the song that made garage and later on punk possible.
Well, he's from Dunn, North Carolina, and like a lot of early rock and rollers, he got his start playing in hillbilly groups. But rock and roll hit, and he started to play with that sort of energy. And his first record was Rumble, which he did for Archie Blyer's Candace label back in 1958. He actually recorded it on his own and sent it in to Archie, and Archie heard it, and well, he passed on it initially. I mean, Archie was hip enough to have the Everly Brothers on his label, but he was more in tune with, you know, people like Andy Williams, who he had a lot of hits with before Andy bolted for Columbia. But Archie's daughter thought it was really cool. It actually kind of reminded her of the fight scenes in West Side Story. And that's what made Archie put it out under the title Rumble. I don't even know if it had a title. I think Link might have just sent it to him without really even thinking about song titles. Or if it had a title, it wasn't Rumble. Yeah, it came out, and it was a top 20 hit. But Archie got a lot of bad press about it. Because, again, this is when you had the mainstream press who were trying to kill rock and roll by giving it a bad name without realizing that they were actually making kids want it even more by... bringing up the fact that, hey, this is going to promote gang warfare. The kid said, yeah, hell yeah, let's go slash some tires. Yeah. But Archie got cold feet on putting out anything else by Link. So Link then went to Epic Records for a couple of years, but they tried to tone him down too. And then he put out a record or two on his own Rumble label. But by the top of the 60s, he's with Swan, which was actually Dick Clark's label. And, for that matter, Ronnie Dawson put out a record on Swan, Ain't That a Kick in the Head, and Hazel. And it was kind of a teeny bopper label because it was about that time. But, Link still put out records on Swan from 60 to 66. And during that time, Swan also issued a record in the summer of 63 by an English band called The Beatles. They put out She Loves You.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, they got a little bit of promotion a few months later, but it ended up stiffing on Swan. Swan, had hits with, people like Freddie Cannon. But yeah, without, Capitol hitting the U.S. teeny bopper market with a ton of promotion, She Loves You, stiffed. I think Dick played it once on American Bandstand. I think the kids gave it like an 86, one of those. Oh, it's got a good beat, you can dance to it, but that's as much as they thought about it. It wasn't until a few months later that Alan Livingston gave Capitol the green light to put out I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Brian Epstein and George Martin and the Beatles folks said, okay, well, you can put it out if you put $35,000 of promotion behind it. Oh, no one's ever put that kind of promotion behind a 45. But they put it out before they even had spent through that budget. The record had taken off in a big way, and there was Beatlemania, and there was, for a lot of people, the 60s.
But back to Link, Ray, and Rumble. Man, that song seems to be the go-to song for a whole lot of soundtracks.
It is kind of a rockabilly era Green Onions. I mean, you see it in tons of movies and tons of commercials, and there's a lot more to Link, Ray than just
Rumble. Do you think?
Pulp Fiction. For better or for worse, I mean, that soundtrack did bring a lot of these recordings to, Gen Xers who maybe hadn't heard them before. But they also, it also almost ruined them for those of us who had loved them before that had come out. Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield, there is no better recording on earth, but I'm sick to death of it because of that. And again, just like a lot of people think that Rumble is the only thing Link Ray ever did, a lot of people think that Son of a Preacher Man is the only thing Dusty ever did. They both made volumes of music outside of those, one songs that's, definitely worth listening to.
Next up, the woman dubbed as the female Elvis, Janis Martin, with her song, My Boy Elvis.
Everybody, come on down. The man with the guitar just hit town. Takes off like a rocket, there he goes. Rocking from his head down to his toes. My boy Elvis, real rock. My boy Elvis, real rock. With family, Elvis sing for me.
Well, Janis was born in 1940. She was 5 years younger than Elvis was, and she was out of Virginia. But when RCA, Victor, started to have some luck with Elvis in the spring of 1956 with Heartbreak Hotel, they started to realize, okay, let's get some more of this style of music. And one of the first artists they stumbled upon was Janis. She was 16 years old. And she was playing in that style, kind of derived from hillbilly music, but also with a touch of rhythm and blues, like a lot of the teenage kids were listening to at the time. And her first record was one called Drugstore Rock and Roll. And they thought, okay, well, how can we market this girl? Well, she's playing music similar to Elvis. She's singing in kind of a similar style, so let's call her the female Elvis. And they ran that by Elvis and Colonel Tom, Elvis's manager. But they thought, okay, yeah, that's fine. Because, again, you know, as far as they knew, this was going to last maybe 6 months. And they weren't getting as picky as, you know, Colonel Wood eventually, yeah, with his boy Elvis. So RCA started to promote Janis as the female Elvis, but her records never really took off. No female rockabillies did in the 50s, Wanda Jackson or Brenda Lee's early stuff, you know, Laura Lee Perkins, Joanne Campbell. I mean, a lot of these, you know, women made some fantastic red hot records, but the mainstream public was struggling to come to grips even with just Elvis, yeah, and, you know, and Little Richard and Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran and Buddy Holly. And eventually they did, but they were not ready for a woman to be singing something so powerful and suggestive. I mean, their minds would have been blown if they would have heard Charlene Arthur in the early 50s doing a similar thing before, you know. I mean, Elvis was still in Humes High School when Charlene Arthur was making her records. And what ended up happening was, after a couple of records, Janis toured Europe with a package tour featuring Jim Reeves, and she went to see her sweetheart, who was in the service at the time, and he knocked her up, and she got pregnant, and RCA realized that, okay, we're not going to be able to promote a pregnant 18-year-old girl, so goodbye. But she made some terrific, great, 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 great records, and yeah, the Bear Family CD, The Female Elvis, collects them all, 30 songs all together, and it's prime 50s female rock and roll, and there's just one example of it right there.
I'll trade you my love for your love, baby, all my devotion to boot. I'll trade you my love for your love, baby, all my devotion to boot. So if you feel you'd like to make a deal, cock your pistol and root a toot toot. Bang, 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 bang.
Well, it's only fair that we include the male Janis Martin, Elvis Presley, and we talked about his legacy.
Well, I'm a-working on a building, it's a true foundation. I'm a-holding up the bloodstain, banner for my Lord. Well, I never get tired, tired, tired of working on a building. I'm a-going up to heaven, oh, yeah, to get my reward, my reward. Well, I'm a-working.
I think something that makes a lot of people maybe not appreciate him is the way the media has portrayed him. Especially in the years since his passing. A lot of people who didn't grow up listening to him think of him as, oh, he's the weird fat guy who died on the toilet, or he's the guy who said, thank you very much. And, I mean, they know him for that, the way people know Cary Grant as saying, Judy, Judy, Judy. But actually, Cary Grant never said Judy, Judy, Judy in any movie. Just impressionists over the years realized that with that word, they could do a Cary Grant impression. So they perpetuated that image. And if you listen to Elvis's live albums, you know, from the 70s, he says, thank you very much, a time or two. But my God, he didn't say it after every song. And even in an interview from the 50s on the Elvis Sales EP that came out, as he's being shipped off to Germany, he does say thank you very much, but he doesn't say thank you very much. So I think the media has overly simplified him for mass consumption, and people don't think of him as a cultural force the way they should have. What the genius of Elvis is that he, without even realizing he was doing it, merged all these different factions of society that needed to come together. He brought hillbilly music together with blues, together with pop vocal. He wanted to be Dean Martin, but he also wanted to sing Arthur Crudup songs and Wynonie Harris songs and you know, Bill Monroe songs. So he was mixing
and gospel songs too. I mean,
yeah, eventually, yeah, he didn't do that at Sun, but yeah, he would, you know, he wanted to join the Blackwood Brothers in the early 50s. He actually tried out after a plane crash killed a couple of their members. And he would go to their all-night sings in Memphis. Yeah, he wanted to be a Blackwood brother, but he also wanted to be Dean Martin. When he went to Sun in search of, you know, connecting with Mr. Phillips under the auspices of, you know, making a record for his mama's birthday, yeah, but it was months away from her birthday, so you know he was going there just to be heard by Mr. Phillips. You know, Sam Phillips was always out, but thank God Marion Keister, who was Sam's gal Friday, recorded Elvis, she pressed up the record for him, and she took his name and number and was prodding Sam, you gotta listen to this kid. There's really something about him. But he was singing pop vocal standards. He was singing Ink Spots songs. And, you know, he came in to audition eventually for Sam, and Sam brought in Bill Black and Scotty Moore from Doug Poindexter's group to back him up. And the first few songs that they were doing were all kind of pop vocal standards, like Harbor Lights and I Love You Because, which was kind of a country weeper. You know, but they were all, you know, crooner songs, basically, Blue Moon. And it wasn't until the band was taking a break and they started to horse around, Elvis just started to bang on the guitar and letting off some steam by playing That's All Right, which is an Arthur Crudup record from 1946 that he'd always dug. And you had Bill Black, who was always up for playing the fool, you know, slapping away on his bass, and Scotty Moore just started to pick along with it. And that's when Sam realized, okay, here we go. Here is what I've been looking for a couple of years. And that's when he, you know, got on the control room mic and said, okay, think about what you're doing a little bit and let's do it again. And they formulated, you know, that record that, you know, did bring that somewhat cleaned up, scrubbed up white boy singing rhythm and blues music to the masses. But again, the flip side of Elvis was always, you know, the countryside. So eventually, after a few more days, they did a rocked up version of Bloomin' in Kentucky, the Bill Monroe song, which Bill Monroe did as a waltz, but they put it in 4/4 time and, you know, kicked it up and slapped that on the B-side. Bill Monroe, stodgy old Bill Monroe, was impressed enough with that record to where he did a new version of it in that arrangement himself. So yeah, it's really Elvis as, you know, this person who brought together a lot of factions of society that I think we can thank him for. Little Richard himself says, you know, Elvis kicked down the door. Because, you know, Little Richard was making records for RCA in 53 that weren't getting any airplay except on black radio stations and selling to a small, you know, black audience. But after Elvis kicked down the door and started to make records like that, then Little Richard's records, Tutti Frutti, Long Tall Sal, They Slip and Slide and what have you, did have a place on white radio. And then another year or two go by, you've got Little Rock, you've got, you know, integration happening, you've got the civil rights movement. All, you know, I'm not going to say that Elvis is solely responsible for it, but I do think that Elvis helped soften a lot of white people to the idea that, hey, it's okay if we use the same drinking fountains as, you know, these folks who are, you know, from a couple blocks away.
Yeah.
Now, Wanda Jackson had trouble with that in Montana in 58. She was on tour, and she had Big Al Downing playing piano for her. And I've heard that, I heard it was in Butte, but I've also heard it was in Billings, which is my hometown. But I heard that she was getting on stage at a, you know, a country and western club to do a set, and they saw this, you know, Fats Domino looking guy sit down on the piano, and the guy who owned the bar said, Wanda, we're not going to be able to have him play with you tonight. And she said, well, pack it up, boys. You know, if you want Wanda Jackson tonight, you're going to have Big Al Downing playing with me, or else forget it. And he said, okay, that the show can go on. So, yeah, you know, we do have a lot of, you know, good-hearted, you know, rock and roll people coming from a country music background who realize that, you know, we're all on the same planet together, and I dig your music, you dig mine, so let's work together. And, you know, thankfully, over the decades, it's been slow going, and it's still slow now in some pockets of society. But yeah, you know, I think it is getting the memo across.
Slowly but surely, the table's gonna turn. Slowly but surely, your lips are gonna burn for what you've been missing. My kind of kissing, my kind of love. Slowly but surely, I'm gonna make you mine.
All right, next up, the Possum, George Jones.
Well, with someone new you're affiliated, and it's making me feel like I'm outdated. If I don't love you, it ain't groceries, and that's on every poor man's plate.
George is, for a lot of folks, well, the best pure country singer that's, you know, maybe ever walked. I think George himself would probably say Hank Williams was. But yeah, it's hard to think of a better, more expressive, just pure vocalist in country music. than George Jones. He's from Belmont, Texas, I believe, born in, 1931? And, you know, like a lot of, you know, people born right about that time, you know, he worshipped, you know, folks like Hank Williams, Eddie Arnold when he was still in his hillbilly phase, long before he ever became a Perry Como-style crooner for the country market. Lefty Frizzell, Carl Smith, you know, all the stuff that was big when George was, a teenager and a young adult. And, you know, when he went to his first recording session with Pappy Daly for the Stardate label in Houston, you know, Pappy said, okay, well, I've heard you sing like Hank Williams. I've heard you sing like Lefty Frizzell. I've heard you sing like, you know, several other folks. Now I want you to sing like George Jones. And, you know, like a lot of people, you know, his age, he was, you know, emulating his heroes. But he had to actually think, okay, who am I? Mm-hmm. And he started just let her roar and made a lot of fantastic up-tempo hillbilly records for Starday, and, you know, some of which got issued by Mercury, too, through a deal that Starday had, which also led to Mercury distributing Chantilly Lace for the Big Bopper in 58, making it a national hit instead of just the regional hit it was in Texas on the D label, which was a subsidiary of Starday. But yeah, you know, George Jones made just tons of fantastic hillbilly records there in the 50s, and even a little bit of rockabilly once rock and roll started to take off under the name Thumper Jones. This is something that a lot of people did, because in 56, when it took off nationally, rockabilly and rock and roll, a lot of country artists, especially the younger ones, thought, well, this isn't that far removed from what we do, so should we give this a shot? So you had Farron Young and Gene Shepherd, making a few, you know, records that were a little more up-tempo, a little edgier than their normal fare. You had Buck Owens making the record Hot Dog and Rhythm and Booze under the name Corky Jones. And you had George Jones giving it a shot under the name Thumper Jones. And the whole reason that, you know, he used the pseudonym, as did Buck, although Buck wasn't as well-established, was George was pretty well-established with a few, you know, honky-tonk hits, Why Baby Why, Color of the Blues, Seasons of My Heart, I'm sorry. And he was pretty well-established as a country artist. And he realized that a lot of older country music fans did not like rock and roll at all. And if they ever got word that George Jones had made a rock and roll record, they would write him off. The same thing happened with Sam Cooke when he started to make some secular records on Specialty. He called himself Dale Cooke, and he didn't want to piss off his gospel audience, who was used to him singing with the Soul Stirrers. Because again, if you make a secular record, you're in with the devil. You know, you have gone against God. So his first few secular records were under the name Dale Cooke. And George Jones made, well, he covered Heartbreak Hotel, for instance, and he had a really good record called Rocket.
I'm gonna rock, rock, rock my blues away. We'll rock them all night long. Don't I mean rockin'? Yeah, rockin', rockin', rockin'. Yeah, baby, when I'm rockin', I wanna rock it with you.
But none of them took off as hits, and so he, you know, continued making records then that were more along the lines of hillbilly and country of the time as George Jones. And I've found out that a lot of singers of that era don't like records they made that weren't hits. It's not even just a country thing. It's a pop thing. I think I've heard that Connie Francis, you know, doesn't like any of the 8 singles that predate Who's Sorry Now. Because a lot of these people just think, well, if it wasn't a hit, I guess it wasn't a good record.
With some musicians, their performances offstage are far more interesting than their performances on stage. So I asked Kells to talk about George Jones's famous lawnmower incident.
Oh, don't know exactly when it was. I think it was, you know, mid-70s, and George by that point was very, very much a mainstream country music star. He'd left Stardate and Mercury. He'd had a stint at United Artists from 62 to 64. Then he stayed with Pappy Daly and his MusiCorps label from 64 through 71. But by this point, he had met, fallen in love with, and married Tammy Wynette, who was on the Epic label, being produced by Billy Sherrill. And once his MusiCorps contract expired, he jumped over to Epic so he and Tammy could record duet records together. And for a couple years, that worked well, but George did have a little bit of an alcohol problem. And Tammy was trying to keep him away from the booze. And it got to a point where, you know, she didn't want him to drive. So she'd hide the car keys, thinking, well, if he can't drive, he can't go to the liquor store. He can't go to a bar. Well, she didn't think at all about the fact that, you know, if someone's, you know, really got a problem and they need that substance in their bloodstream, they're going to find any way to get there. And at some point, yeah, 74, 75, I don't remember exactly when it was, but yeah, George said, well, I can't find the keys to the damn car, so damn it, I'll just take the damn lawnmower. And he found the keys to the riding lawnmower, got on it, and was cruising down the highway at whatever, you know, 8 or 10 miles an hour to get to the closest liquor store or bar, whatever it was. I read the story in his book a long time ago. It's been 15 years since I read it, so I couldn't give you the exact details. Yeah. But yeah, he found a way to get that demon in his system. And yeah, and again, just like with Elvis being famous for the, you know, the crazy fat guy that died on the toilet, a lot of people, George Jones, he's the guy who wrote the lawnmower to the liquor store. And it's like, yeah, it's a funny story, but there's also, you know, 30 hours of music that you need to concentrate on more than that story. But there's, you know, there's also his Dweedly Duck story. He ended up getting a second personality that he called Dweedly Duck. And he would start to speak to people in the Dweedly Duck voice, which is like a Donald Duck, you know, type of voice. And it stopped being a cute novelty because sometimes Dweedly Duck would take over with George, and sometimes George would speak to himself in the Dweedly Duck voice, and Dweedly Duck would start telling George Jones what to do. Sometimes he would even get out and start a concert, and he'd sing the first song in the Dweedly Duck voice. And if he started a concert with White Lightning or, you know, an up-tempo novelty song, you know, people might say, oh, great, that's so funny. Oh, that's crazy old George. He's acting up. But then the second song might be a heart song. He might sing She Thinks I Still Care or He Stopped Loving Her Today. And the Dweedly Duck voice would come out. And, the booze would start coming. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Don't sing this song in that voice. But it was a case of, you know, Dweedly Duck had taken over, and George couldn't shake him. So, you know, again, I think Dweedly Duck has been put to rest through, you know, his wife Nancy and through, you know, chemical treatment. But yeah, that was a real problem too. So again, these make for funny stories, but it must have been an absolute nightmare. It's like, you know, it's like Brian Wilson, you know, being in bed for several months there in the early 70s. Oh, it's you know, kind of funny to think of now. Oh, crazy Brian and his sandbox piano, and oh, he's in bed, he can't get out of bed. But it must have been absolute abject misery for the person himself at the time.
And the people that loved him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Dennis Wilson, of course, was, you know, always really concerned about Brian. But he would, you know, keep the problem going by telling, you know, Brian, oh, okay, hey, I've got a bag of 12 hamburgers here for you, Brian. For each song you write for me, I'll give you a hamburger. So he was an enabler, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was doing it out of love. He just maybe wasn't the right decision.
One day I ventured in love, never once suspecting what the final result would be. How I lived in fear of waking up each morning and finding that you'd gone from me. There's aching and pain in my heart, for the day was the one that I hated to face. Somebody new came up to win her, and I came out in second place. Now the race is on, and here comes pride at the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running. True love scratched for another's sake. The race is on, and it looks like heartaches, and the winner loses all.
You've reached the end of part one of my conversation with Kells Cook. Now flip the record over to listen to part two.